an interesting session in the sense that I am presenting Hanok Dagan's paper, Pluralism and Perfection in Private Law. Hanok has been a regular participant at these workshops, and if you know his work, you'll understand the importance of it. I mean, it's I think, foundational in many regards. Hanok mentioned that he had really wanted to present this paper to this group, but couldn't. He's the dean, almost done his tenure at Tel Aviv, but he's the dean at Tel Aviv and had a major event with a long-standing donor, and this was something, therefore, that he couldn't make. So he expressed sincere regret, and we suggested, well, we can have the discussion anyway, and for the purposes of commentary, we can record the discussion and send it to you. So that's why we have the McGill ICS people here. They will record us, and we will send the DVD along to Hanok, and hopefully our comments will be in some way instructive to him. So again, this is a pleasure, a favor to a long-standing member of the group, if you will, but also one who is a conscientious contributor. I don't know if I think in a very moral sense, what goes around comes around. If you've ever been to a conference with Hanok, he is the one who is listening at every single presentation. He's the one who's intervening at every single presentation and takes care and attention to contribute to other colleagues' work. And I think this is, at least from my perspective, a labor of love. So there we are. Pluralism and perfectionism in private law. I said a foundational piece, and I mean it. He's arguing here for a foundational pluralism for the whole of private law, property, and I would say intellectual property as well. The idea is that there are monist theories of law, and there are potentially pluralist theories of law. Monist theories of law, those are those in which a single value or goal or orientation, I suppose, is what is privileged in the normative structure of the legal system in place. In this case, his main example would be exclusion theories. We've already seen one very illustrative diagram a few moments ago with Eduardo's presentation. So exclusion being the paradigmatic virtue or structure or value that is privileged within the structure of private property norms. It could be welfare. We've seen welfareism in a larger utilitarian picture, or even a law and economics picture. Some value, some kind of utility. Again, pointing towards one overarching goal, norms then are oriented around this. The values, I suppose the value or the argumentative value, the persuasive value of a monist theory, I think, as Hanok identifies, are obvious to many of us. They are parsimonious. They are elegantly simple, I would say, elegantly simple, coherent. So if everything revolves around this single value, this single goal, it's easier to construct a nicely structured, coherent system that serves this goal. Now, there is, or there are, I suppose, problems with these kinds of systems. And Hanok identifies, I think, three extremely powerful critiques of exclusion theories of property as a specific critique of monist theories of property. Here he is on page 910 of the paper. Exclusion theorists need to choose among three alternatives, none of which seems particularly promising. One, probably the most prevalent option, is to redefine property law so as to set aside the rather capacious aspects of it in which either inclusion or governance loom large. So in other words, exclusion doesn't capture everything. So the opposite of these very simple, elegant theories is that they just don't get the whole of the picture. If there are other elements of the picture, other aspects of the picture, that simply can't be explained. Alternatively, exclusion theorists may discard any pretense to account for our existing legal landscape, present their theory as reformist, advocating a significant legal change that will use exclusion as property's sole regulative principle, thus making property law truly libertarian. So pushing exclusion theory towards the right-based, here he puts, this seems to be the implicit path of the recent revival of the Kantian conception of property. Shoehorning, in service of this principle, shoehorning the theory, in this case, towards a liberal rights-based theory, which, again, may not be accurate or representative. Finally, with respect to exclusion theorists, they may follow Felix Cohen in claiming that every property right indeed involves some power to exclude others from doing something. Well, as he points out, that's a rather modest truism, which hardly yields any practical implications. So in this case, the conclusion on exclusion theory is the failure of exclusion theory does not necessarily condemn other monistic accounts of property, but given the prominence of exclusion as a characteristic feature of property and the way in which the way at least some of its critique applies mutatis mutandis to other attempts to divide the conceptual core of property, it seems advisable to pause in the quest for property's core and consider an altogether different way of thinking about property. So exclusion as, I suppose, an archetypal or even prototypical kind of monist theory with respect to property is rejected because it doesn't capture all of it or requires too much shoehorning or doesn't say anything at all at the end of the day that is useful about the institution. In larger terms, I suppose, and I like this metaphor, he would rather see the messiness of, I suppose, the reality of property norms captured by a kind of theory that doesn't exclude, I suppose, different kinds of goals or values to be served. So it's a mosaic, of principles instead of a mess. The monist sees a mess, the pluralist sees a mosaic. And here the pluralist points to values such as autonomy, utility, labor, personhood, community, or distributive justice, each of which accounts for different aspects of the institution or explains different parts of the institutions in a foundational way, which means there isn't one that takes priority over any of the others. So this pluralistic account, admitting it is controversial, does a better job of explaining more, and indeed, gets to the deeper kinds of normative questions that one ought to ask with respect to understanding an institution as complex, as heterogeneous as private property. Again, I would add intellectual property to the mix. There is also a path, if you will, or even a, and I don't want to use this in a negative sense, a pathology, if you will, towards the institution of private property. So it isn't just heterogeneous in the fact there are plenty of values out there, and we as we've seen in previous papers, Greg's paper in particular, we simply order. There is some direction to it, and he calls this a moderate perfectionism, that in some way, shape, or form, like other parts of law, private law plays a role in all the functions of law, namely resolving disputes, channeling, coordinating people's conduct, distributing entitlements and obligations, expressing values. So there's a facilitative role in particular that is particularly significant to law, and therefore pushes gently law in a certain direction. Now, this isn't a strong perfectionist account, or I suppose one might say a strong Aristotelian or teleological account, pushing strongly in a certain direction, but it's gently pushing in this direction of ordering. So, in that sense, it's not completely neutral. So this is on page 18. Private law perfectionism, however, is not the only inevitable consequence of the failure of private law neutrality. It is, in fact, compatible with, indeed closely related to, structural pluralism. Pluralism and perfectionism can happily cohabit for three reasons. First, and most obviously, value pluralism, even of the foundational stripe, is different from the philosophically suspect meta-ethical positions of value relativism, skepticism, or nihilism, which undermine any possibility of moral justification, evaluation, or for that matter, criticism, thus undermining the idea of law itself. Rather, alongside a laudable recognition of a broad menu of incommensurable human alternatives, value pluralism justifiably acknowledges a minimal core of moral truths. Forms of life differ, and moral principles are many, but not infinitely many, that they must be within the human horizon. So there is a sense, in which this perfectionism is pushing forward in a moral way in its regulation of human interaction, and in doing so helps to foster human interaction and in a sense foster human flourishing. So again, there's a mild perfectionist account in here, following Raz, following Nussbaum, and others in some of the terms that we have heard already. All of this points to the idea that therefore property as we know it, is a series of institutions. Again, the umbrella metaphor comes in. I offer a structurally pluralist and moderately perfectionist understanding of property, in which property is an umbrella for a set of institutions, property institutions, bearing family resemblances. Each such property institution entails a specific composition of entitlements that constitute the contents of an owner's rights vis-a-vis others. So, wide range of institutions that serves a wide variety of values, gently pushing forward in this perfectionist human development mode. And in this sense, the umbrella is pretty wide. It obviously catches intellectual property, but other forms of property, family property, and that sort of thing, that all become part of the institution. So the practical payoff of discarding property monism in favor of structural pluralism lies in the fact that the latter approach situates the normative inquiries regarding property at the correct level. Thus, on the one hand, it resists smuggling normatively disputed claims by way of purportedly conceptual presumptions. So this account makes its presumptions clear. It makes the discussions of value live discussions, debated discussions, as opposed to just assuming them away with some sort of conceptual term like exclusion, which does a lot of that work. And on the other hand, it structures these normative inquiries so that they properly address both the social context and the nature of the resource. Well, I love that last line. If you know my work, and there we have it. So a wonderful, again, foundational piece in a number of different ways, not just in terms of Hanok's argument, but I think in terms of orienting our own various projects. I have a few things I want to throw out before opening the door.
Just to add that because Hanok and I have worked together closely in a cooperative book, we've discussed this paper and this idea at some length. I think it's important to stress that Hanok's version of pluralism is what he calls structural pluralism, not simply value pluralism. And by structural pluralism, he means, and here's the importance of the emphasis on institutions, that there are different institutions that property law deals with. Indeed, Hanok's understanding of property law itself is that property law is, among other things, a set of institutions. And that those institutions are normatively guided by particular dominant values. So we'll allocate the value of community to one institution, say the family, and to a very different institution, say the market, a quite different value, say efficiency, and so on. And here then is sense of structural pluralism. But he also emphasizes repeatedly that at the bottom of this, and here he's following Roz, the pluralism is autonomy-based. So Hanok is very much committed to a vision that is thoroughly liberal. Hence, autonomy is, as I read the paper, and Hanok, as you're watching this, if I have this wrong, please let me know. As I read the paper, autonomy is a foundational value of which there are multiple bearers with distinct values, but all of which values can be reduced to one ultimate singular value, and that is autonomy. This he wants to distinguish, this structural pluralism, he really wants to distinguish from the exclusionary theorists whom he views as clearly monists. By the exclusionary theorists he has in mind, people like Tom Merrill and Henry Smith. He understands their theory to be indisputably, structurally speaking, monists. And he critiques that much in the way that Elizabeth Anderson, whose value theory clearly influences him, as Roz does, critiques value monism is so reductionist as to completely distort our experiences. Our experiences in evaluation and our experiences in law. He thinks that it has many important insights, but we simply cannot reduce law structurally to any singular value. Monism or exclusion is important, but it's neither conceptually the sine qua non of law, nor is, from a utilitarian standpoint, wealth maximization the only important value in law. So, and I'm putting it a different way, there's a kind of Michael Walzer-esque aspect of this, following Michael Walzer's influence on spheres of justice. Where, like Walzer, Hanok is looking at different spheres of social life that property touches upon and regulates. And he says that these different values don't bump up against each other because they're allocated to these different spheres. But at the bottom of it, at the root, is autonomy.
Yeah, I think, thank you. I think those are
excellent, excellent qualifications or additions to the picture. I just wanted to raise a few points, and they're based a great deal on what Greg has just said. First of all, in terms of the relation between the individual and the community, I think Greg's absolutely right to say that Hanok is a perhaps more autonomy-based structural pluralist than other potential pluralists in this room. right? There might be in the tension between individual and community, or the resolution of the tension between individual and community, a more community-oriented or non-individual-oriented kind of pluralism, at least in some of the spheres, that wouldn't always necessarily resolve in favor of individual autonomy when push came to shove. And I think that's true looking back into Hanok's other work as well, in terms of his positioning in liberal communitarian debates generally. So the question is how... is there a danger in the way Hanok has cast this theory of making autonomy the overarching value, right? So as opposed to being a foundational pluralist, maybe he's pushing it back towards another kind of potentially even pluralism, where autonomy has, I suppose, the final say or the final trump card. I have an interesting point for Hanok based on a conference last week. Could you not use this, looking at the camera now, could you not use this whole text as a good argument for property exceptionalism, something you were arguing against last week? So in other words, is there something in the institutional structures of private property that in some way, and the values that it serves, that in some way makes a case for treating property differently than other parts of private law? In particular on a question like the numerous clauses. That may not interest everybody here, but I hopefully that question will interest Hanok based on what was said at an IP and common law conference last week.
I'm curious about how this resonates with the IP people in the group. Structural pluralism.
Right. And finally, how moderate is moderate? In terms of perfectionism. I mean, this, I suppose, ties the individual community point, but you may wish to take a much more stronger teleological or even Aristotelian position and say that the system's pushing further towards community development, human development, etc.
So following up on that, I mean, I agree that in this structural pluralist approach, there is a very classical liberal understanding of pluralism across groups or institutions. So patents is one institution where Hanok says, you know, efficiency should rule, and the family community values should rule. But I think that as an IP person, but also somebody who has written a lot about this particular conception of pluralism, to the extent to, I mean, my critique has long been that it ignores diversity within and plural values within each institution. For example, families, we have diverse members of families, we have unequal power relationships within families, and so that always raises questions about equality and freedom as well as community. And of course, in the IP context, patents, they certainly incentivize knowledge production, but at the same time, they also promote disclosure and social values. Historically, patents have always been contingent on, I mean, back in the Venetian city-state, the idea was that you could only be granted your patent to the extent to which it didn't provoke any nuisance or disturb the state in any other way. Really broad limits on the use of one's patent. So I think, which would, of course, bring in all sorts of questions, such as morality and fairness. The TRIPS agreement, for example, also has strong protections to allow for states to meet their health needs and to democratically deliberate with respect to their own constitutional values. Some countries have a constitutional right to health. So basically, the critique is that in allowing in some amount of this mosaic and saying, you know, we're not afraid of the messiness, I still think there's a bit too much order here in the sense of carefully crafting the pluralism across groups, but then having monism within groups. And I think that I would push for more recognition of the multiple values at stake within these various institutions.
camera. And offer some general nodding in agreement to that point. So you should be warned. Mark.
So, go ahead.
Okay, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, this is an IP crowd that I think is struggling with the question of whether or not IP is really all about efficiency. And we're trying to develop our languages for that kind of behavior.
Yeah, I would echo that too.
I was going to say much of the same thing. I mean, I think, so it's interesting to me that, I mean, a lot of this depends on sort of the level at which you want to talk about the institutions, right? So you could divide between patent and copyright as sort of different institutions. But you also actually might divide even among them, and sort of so the idea of thinking of different institutions effectuating different values within IP is appealing to me. But I wouldn't nearly so quickly concede that patent law is all about efficiency, right? Because patent law touches on lots of other really important things like access to medicine, right? And so I to me, you might say, well, patent law itself is committed to efficiency, and because it's only structured in a way that's good at doing that, it means we need to account for the other values in other institutions, but deliberately in recognition of what patent law does poorly, right? So you might say, in response to saying, you know, we're not going to commit all of our innovation policy to patent law because we know it leaves out all these other values, therefore we have to pick up the slack in university funding of basic research or in, you know, creating prizes for certain kinds of development. And I think the concern, my concern about saying something like, well, patent law is about efficiency, is that it plays very easily into the hands of people who then say, okay, so therefore we don't have to worry about any of those other values because we recognize patent law as the place we deal with innovation. Right. And so I think there's just a disconnect between the sort of institutional pluralism point and then conceding maybe so easily in those different different areas. The other thing, I mean, I think it actually plays very nicely into, there's something of a thread development in the IP scholarship about tailoring within IP to different industries and to different use situations. And I think this actually maps, it's still using different language, but it maps pretty nicely.
I mean, I guess you might answer, for the purposes of covering a wide range of property or property-like institutions, sure, I had to say here's an archetypal value of efficiency with respect to patent, but I really agree with you. So that might be one potential answer. The other, I suppose, is there a value, at what point do we really simply descend into value relativism, or if you want to take an even more skeptical viewpoint, the point where we can't differentiate or order all of these various plural kinds of structures. So maybe the other response is, well, yeah, but at some point you do have to be a little bit of a monist somewhere along the line in each of these areas. I don't know which might be his response.
Maybe that's not inconsistent with what I said about saying you might see to patent law saying, okay, so patent law is going to do efficiency here, but then recognize that then you have to account for the other values outside of the IP system or outside of at least the patent law system, and not, it may be that you can't optimize patent law to maximize all those values within that system, and so you commit it to pursuing efficiency, but then you account for it outside of patent law. But then I think that's just taking a holistic view of either innovation policy or whatever you want to call it, and thinking of patent law as a subspecies of that rather than the place that it happens. And then,
Kaylee and Abraham both had your hand. You guys decide as the three. Okay.
You sure you don't
want to? I'm fine right now.
So I
say something to provoke her.
Actually, I say something to provoke you. I wanted to sort of, I'm very attracted to this idea of the structural pluralism that is, well, it's more than that, right? Structural, autonomy-based structural pluralism, right? It's not just structural, or I guess structural means autonomy-based pluralism. So here's what I'm understanding by the sort of language. So let's play it with copyright, which I think I know something about some days. So let's say that one were to agree that there's a single value at the heart of copyright, and that there is pluralism in the system to the extent to which this sphere, to pick up Walter's term, must in some situations be understood to be related to other spheres, say the sphere of constitutional freedom of expression guarantees. And so there will be copyright cases, or cases that involve copyright that may be determinable on the single and the single value that defines the copyright system. We call it an easy case. I'm not sure that any case is easy, but let's call it an easy case. And then there are more difficult cases. These cases actually raise questions about the boundaries between spheres or about overlap between spheres, right? So I take it now, and in a way I'm going back to Greg's conversation earlier as well. So in a way now, I think I hear this, and I want to be corrected, that the kind of reasoning I would use to decide the easy copyright case, the intra-copyright problem, is one. And then the kind of reasoning that I would use to decide the interaction between spheres problem is another kind of reasoning. And the paper here is structurally pluralist in the sense that while it admits that there are easy cases that can be derivable from a single variable within spheres, it nonetheless wants to appeal to multiple spheres when it wants multiple values when it wants to talk about the interaction between them. But I think that unless we're going to appeal to Greg's conception, which might be the one to go with, I want to know more about the second kind of reasoning, or this kind of reasoning that permits me to mediate conflicts between spheres. Because I actually don't see how efficiency is autonomy-based at all. So I don't understand how you can say, well, I'm an autonomy-based pluralism and I grant a patent to efficiency. I'm saying, you grant anything to efficiency, autonomy is out the window. There's nothing efficient about autonomy. Autonomy is our most inefficient value. Let's face it, right? I mean, like, autonomy is so inefficient, I don't see how you're going to derive. So if you're a pluralist, I can see you're doing efficiency here and autonomy there. But if you're a structural pluralist, I think the idea of structural limits the kind of values you can go around saying institutions serve. Efficiency can't be one of them. Efficiency can't be a sovereign value in any of these spheres because efficiency contradicts autonomy. That seems to me the basic problem of liberalism, right? You're either going to be efficient, which, in which case you're not a liberal, you're a market theorist. That's not quite a liberal. A lot of liberals are market theorists. But no, not every liberal has to be a market theorist. So liberal, truly liberal theorists, I think in Greg's sense, or in the rich liberal sense, I would say McPherson sense, you know, the sort of post-Marxist liberals, they have rich concepts of autonomy that can include concepts of relationship, but efficiency can't be one of them. So I would suggest that if this is going to be truly an autonomy-based pluralism, they can't grant efficiency as a guiding value in any of the spheres. And there will be some, for example, discrimination is a value. You can't admit it. You can't have a sphere of discrimination either. But autonomy will say, well, no. So you can't have, you know, this is the racist aspect of society, and it interacts. It can't. It's out of the picture. Right? So I think the monism has to sort of, I don't know if I'm going to call it monism, because that seems to be a dirty word around here, but let's call it something else, right? The ordering principle in the absence of which we collapse into schizophrenic despair. We'll call it whatever you want, right? But there's going to be something that, and maybe it's the, it has to be the practical reasoning,
Do you want to take a shot at this? So, the term that he described, I don't want to put any words in his mouth. The term that he describes, that he uses, is autonomy-based value pluralism. Descriptions of an autonomy-based value pluralism belong, page 11. I think, and again, I'm off if I get this wrong, sorry, I'm doing my best. Is he wants to have autonomy as a limiting principle in the following sense. He doesn't want community or any sort of similar collectivist type of notions or values to ultimately trump autonomy. So a clear example of that is the importance that he places in earlier articles and in his book on, to use the Albert Hirschman language, on things. Mm-hmm. Right? In any sort of organization where you have a familiar Hirschman choices, every choice and loyalty, he always insists that there be a robust exit option. Why autonomy? Whereas he claims that more robust communitarians, and he sometimes includes Eduardo and me in that group, and we've had this argument, we think that he misreads us, are quite willing to place limits on exit that he finds anti-liberal and sacrificing autonomy. So that's an attempt to answer.
I'm a patent lawyer, so this is coming from sort of patent disarray right now in terms of its contradiction. And I think the one question I had for Hanaf, is that the question I have is how do you manage instability in a model of structural growth? So one of the things that I think the reason why all the IP scholars are sort of focused in right now on the statement that patents is concerned with efficiency is I think that is seriously in doubt right now in terms of, and it's been for a while, in terms about the sort of being the dominant paradigm by which we do patent law. And so I was just wondering.
You mean at least in the way it's actually functioning?
Yeah. I would also say, sort of, if there's a potential, even theoretically, this is what I'm going to talk about a little bit tomorrow, that there's been some inherent stability in how we conceive of patent law. So I guess I was wondering what happens when you have a change in how people are viewing the good and how the structural pluralism deals with that model of structural pluralism deals with that change.
That's a great question, though.
Yeah.
You agree. Yeah. That's a great question.
Yeah.
These are hard questions. I don't know. This
is
ain't my theory.
Oh, yeah. Changing visions of the family, the contract, changing visions of patents, all of that.
Well, where in the model is that explanation for that moment?
Yeah. This actually gets to the question that I have, which is why, the big question is why structuralism? If we're just trying to say, listen, we can only handle a certain amount of diversity of value, of combination, or whatever, you have to make some choices, but why structural? I mean, why the emphasis identifying institutions and then saying that's going to be the breakpoint, as opposed to some other choice, which would simplify to some degree, or something like that, which, of course, feeds into your question, which is, if these institutions are, in fact, highly artificial in our understanding, maybe that's the wrong word, but our understanding of their dominant values is in fact rather artificial because those evolve and so forth over time, then is this really is this basically a descriptive model where we say we are going to associate X value with X institution because at the moment that's what in fact it is. And if it changes, it changes. Okay, we just accept whatever the dominant value is at any given time, and that's our nod towards simplicity or whatever. But
I should follow up on that. I mean, so what's interesting about that though, I mean, is a descriptive thing. I think this is the comment I made sort of responding to Callie's point. I think you see this a lot in IP, is that the dominant way of theorizing about IP is a complete mismatch to actually what's going on in the doctrine. So there's sometimes refusal to sort of engage that, or there's cognitive dissonance about it. But there's actually, I think this is, one would have a very hard time looking at the way that patent law operates in the world and concluding that it's a maximizing efficiency. Because there's just the enormous losses that are going on. I mean, Moyer and Besson's book, I think, demonstrates this really clearly. There's almost no industries in which it's a net gain because there's so much. So you have to engage in lots of convincing of yourself to believe that the patent system is maximizing efficiency. And so then if it's a descriptive account, and it's supposed to be maximizing this, but doctrinally it actually doesn't accomplish that, what's the conclusion you draw from that? I think the conclusion has to be that if you're trying to make a descriptive account, that's actually not the value that it's optimizing. It's doing something else.
Right? Well, it could be an aspiration.
Or maybe a grossly failed one, right? But, I mean, it could be just that what it is mapping some people's views about what the values should be maximizing onto it and trying to explain things and then just ignoring the stuff that doesn't fit.
Laura, was your question sort of, I'm going to repeat what I said in the conference in D.C. on this book, but are you making the point, like, It seems to me that when he talks about institutional pluralism, you know, he says things like, well, the fee simple is where the value of the individual is kind of you know, most fully protected, and then in marital property, you know, the tenancy by the entirety, you kind of institutionalize in a model of spousal equality and community, and then joint tenancy is for communities, and you know, right, where it seems to me that, you know, you can take the fee simple, right, and the fee simple can be used to kind of construct a particular kind of community, right? So the Catholic Church owns often diocesan property in fee simple, right, with the title held by the archbishop as a corporation soul, right? So you have like two forms of property there, right? The corporation and the fee simple, but they're both in service of a very hierarchical conception of control, and then, but a community, right? And then the same fee simple, right? The Amish own their property in the fee simple, right? But at the household level, you're talking about the husband, right? Which institutionalizes one structure, you know, between the husband and wife, but then it's transcended by the communal structure of the Amish, which is highly egalitarian, right? And has all kinds of informal norms of sharing. So it seems to me that the pluralism goes beyond, right? And you have to pluralize, but this is Madhavi's point, you have to pluralize within the individual property institutions. And it's not like there's not just like a domain for community, a domain for individuality. The fee simple is the domain for individuality. The forms of co-ownership are the domain of community. That it just they completely interpenetrate each other.
But I would say not only could you scale that up, but this I didn't realize Dave and I are fellow travelers in the resources and things okay. domain, but we are as it turns out. But you scale it down, right? So there's heterogeneity in terms of the model that he presents that takes the resources as given. But I mean, one of the lessons of ID especially is that, you know, there's an enormous, you know, space for, you know, designing and modifying and sort of constructing how those resources work, and those are institutions in their own rights. And so we need to figure out a way to take account of that variability at the lower scale as well as the kind of higher scale that Cora was talking about.
Jim, one way of understanding, and I'm not at all sure that Hanoff would agree with this, one way of understanding why, or the appeal of structural pluralism is to see that these institutions, these legal or social institutions, are value bearers, so that this really is a form of preference pluralism. That is, he wants to maintain the fundamental commitment to autonomy, but to see multiple institutions which are bearers of values. But the problem is that there are many more bearers of values than simply the kinds of institutions that he discussed or could possibly discuss in any one article or book. It goes way beyond the family or the market or patents. Even if we simply talked about IP, we could slice value bearers if we focus simply upon the question, what are the bearers of relevant values in IP? We could slice that in so many different ways and see so many different bearers of values that it would be very, very unwieldy if we were trying to map all of this out in some kind of orderly, structural way. And I think that's what he wants. He wants to find some way of mapping an order on the multiplicity of bearers of value. But I could be wrong about that. It's just an interpretation.
I guess this reminds me of actually a discussion I had with Tanaka a few years ago about the question of the ownership of property, husband and wives owning property. I think it was the Venice case in Michigan. He was writing an article in this and it generated the instance where the woman And the man and woman owned a car jointly. They were married. And then the man went out and committed crimes in the car. And the question was whether or not the car, therefore, was forfeited over her claim that she was innocent and so on and so forth. And I remember at the time, I think I remember this right, not damaging your position. At the time, he was saying, well, the community aspect is so strong in the family that the woman's, that there should be somehow very strong recognition of the fact that this is a community asset and it should be, because she's the innocent spouse, she should in fact have this vehicle with no problem as far as the way he used, silver and thorn. But of course, within that entire case, there was the question of what about the individual aspect? I mean, you couldn't get away from the fact that if individual wrongdoers or individually innocent parties who were a part of the community unit. So you couldn't, the reason the whole case arose is because we had this tension between the community unit and the individual unit. So to say, for instance, that under structural pluralism we have this idea of the community being dominant in the family relationship is just the surface, right? I mean, the fact that we have disputes and questions and so forth is because it's not really that monistic.
Well, to carry that out, one of the other courses that I teach is Trust and Estates, where we talk about different marital property systems, and it's often common for family lawyers to, in separate property estates, to argue that it would be much fairer to women if community property were transplanted into separate property estates, because community property is based upon the value of partnership, sharing. But as I'm sure Madhavi can tell us, there are plenty of people in community property estates who argue that reality is much messier than that. And that in fact, if what we really wanted was equality, we have separate control. So it is highly contested.
So this conversation makes me think that, by emphasizing this kind of structural pluralism and identifying values that are associated with particular structures puts a lot of pressure on getting the right structure and the right values, and that's what a lot of the conversation is about here. And just to kind of offer an example in the area, I don't take the example of patents, that's the domain, right? But why wouldn't you instead take the domain of, say, science or art?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that would in fact be more parallel to the idea of the family. But if you took the domain of science, I think the kind of what you wouldn't say is science is about efficiency. You'd probably say science is about knowledge, maybe. Science is about community. So, and in fact, I think some of us in the IP world are also, I think, increasingly inclined that I myself, been writing about this, decentering IP as the space of values and the institutional domain of, in fact, the subject of IP law. In fact, it is about something that could be characterized more appropriately as science, art, creative practices. So that might be kind of a way into a question, though, about how we ought to identify the right domains as we're structuring, because it's not obvious. I think one worry that I have about the pluralism element of it is that it may end up simply tracking in an uninterrogated way social categories that already exist and that we all feel comfortable with, like the family, the market, patent law, whereas one of the things that we use a kind of a deeper form of liberalism to do is in fact interrogate those categories in a kind of way that universalizes across them.
Lots of nodding there, man. Lots of nodding around the table. You've got to answer that.
So just to pick up on the third, you were talking about the discussion last week at the common law thing. I mean, the other way in which one can cut the institutional thing here, especially when you're talking about property law, is you've got federalism issues, right? So you could imagine different states doing this differently. You could imagine different states having their property systems keyed toward different issues. So you're not saying, you know, you're not doing it institutionally at the level of property law versus some other kind of law, but, you know, property law and then give spatial, you know, give different areas of the country the ability to embed different kinds of bodies of law. So maybe if you're really committed to institutional pluralism, you might be committed to saying no area of law is an institution, right? It's actually the institution is the body that makes the law, and you should just focus on giving the areas of giving zones of control to different areas so that they can embed the law with different kinds of values.
Which leads to the rhetorical question: if the common law can treat water rights differently, given context, why can't IP treat IP rights differently? Why does it have to all be global? Right? Anyway, there's no answer to that. But yeah. Okay. But it's heresy. I probably would like it, but anyway, there's another.
Is it a substantive theory or a shell theory? In other words, are you saying there's the structure, these shells, about which we make no representations as to what values may emerge? Or are we saying this is a substantive theory, or somehow invested in we being the theorists in the values that are emerging in each of these contexts? Because if you simply say it's a shell theory, doesn't matter. You know, all these problems have changed over time, different visions, it doesn't make any difference. You just say, whatever emerges in the context of the family, that's it, whatever emerges. Of course, then the question becomes, how does that fit together with the autonomy piece, which is definitely a substantive theory. So how do those two visions mesh?
Maybe that's a point to leave it. We do have to allow time to disassemble the setup and let Henri get ready for her talk. Let me just finish with a conversation, Hanok, or a good question that you can ask James Penner. James is one of the exclusion thesis theorists that you point out, and you, I think, quite rightly point out that perhaps a Wittgensteinian family resemblances approach is better. Now, quite ironically, James wrote a long piece on defining property in family resemblances terms, published in the UCLA Law Review. So maybe, Hanok, you should ask James why he appears to have abandoned that very well-written article in favor of a more exclusive rights approach. Anyway, thanks to all of you. Hanok, I hope this is profitable for you. Thanks to Greg for additional context with respect to Hanok's writings, and we'll move on to our next session. Thank you.